it! I've done it!" cried Farid, pulling the door of the cage open. But before the two women could take a step, a figure rose in the darkest corner of their prison, leapt toward them, and seized the first person he could lay his hands on, Meggie's mother.
"Wait," spat Buster. "Stop, stop, not so fast. Where are you off to then, Racer? To join your beloved family? You think I didn't understand all that whispering down in the crypt? Well, I did."
"Let go of her," cried Meggie. "Let go of her." Why hadn't she noticed the dark heap lying so still in the corner? She just assumed Buster was as dead as Capricorn. And indeed, why wasn't he? Why hadn't he disappeared like Flatnose and Cockerel and all the others?
"Let her go, Buster."
Mo spoke very quietly, as if he had no strength for anything else.
"You won't get out of here, even by using her as a shield. No one will help you. They're all gone." "Oh, I'll get out," replied Buster unpleasantly. "I will choke her if you don't let me pass. I'll break her scrawny neck. Did you know she can't talk? She can't make a sound because that useless Darius read her out of the book. She's as silent as a fish, a pretty mute fish. But if I know you, you'll want her back all the same. Am I right?"
Mo made no reply, and Buster laughed.
"Why aren't you dead?" Eleanor shouted at him. "Why didn't you fall down dead like your master, or vanish? Why not?"
Buster merely shrugged.
"How should I know?" he growled, keeping his hand around Racer's neck.
She tried to kick him, but he only tightened his grip.
"After all, the magpie's still here too, but she always made other people do her dirty work for her. And as for me, perhaps I'm one of the good characters in the story now because they put me in the cage. Perhaps I'm still here because it's been a long time since I set fire to anything. And Flatnose got much more fun out of killing people. Perhaps, perhaps, perhaps. But anyway, here I am, so let me pass, you old bookbag."
But Eleanor did not budge.
"No," she said. "You don't get out of here until you let her go. I'd never have expected this story to have a happy ending, but it has. And a creature like you isn't going to spoil that at the last moment, as sure as my name's Eleanor Loredan."
Looking very determined, she placed herself in front of the cage door.
"You don't have your knife with you this time," she went on in a dangerously soft voice. "You have nothing but your filthy tongue. And believe you me, that'll be no use to you now. Poke your fingers into his eyes, Teresa. Kick him, bite him, the beast."
But before Teresa could do as she said, Buster thrust her away from him so violently that she fell against Eleanor and brought her down, her and Mo, for both of them had been coming to her aid. As for Buster, he raced for the open door of the cage, pushed the startled Farid and Meggie aside, and ran away past all the people and creatures still wandering like sleepwalkers around the scene of Capricorn's festivities. Before Farid or Mo could give chase, he had disappeared.
"Oh, great," muttered Eleanor, stumbling out of the cage with Teresa. "Now that wretched fellow will haunt me in my dreams, and every time I hear something rustling out in my garden at night, I will feel his knife at my throat."
Not only had Buster gone, but the magpie also disappeared without a trace that night. And when, wearily, they set off to find a vehicle of some kind to get them away from Capricorn's village, they found all the cars had gone too. Not a single one was left in the parking lot, which was dark now.
"Oh, no, tell me it isn't true," groaned Eleanor. "Does this mean we have to go the whole wretched way on foot again?"
"Unless you happen to have a cell phone with you," said Mo. He had not moved from Teresa's side since Buster had made his escape. He had looked with concern at her neck, where the red marks left by Buster's fingers were still visible, and he had run a strand of her hair through his fingers, and said he almost liked it better now that it was darker. But 9 years is a long time.
and Maggie saw how careful they were with each other, like people on a narrow bridge crossing a wide, wide void. Of course, Eleanor did not have her cell phone. Capricorn had had it taken away from her, and although Farid immediately offered to go and search Capricorn's fire-blackened house for it, it did not turn up. So they finally decided to spend one last night in the village, along with all the creatures that Fenolio had brought back to life. It was still a beautiful, mild night, and sleeping under the trees would be quite comfortable. Maggie and Mo found plenty of blankets in the now deserted houses. But they did not go back into Capricorn's house. Maggie never wanted to set foot inside it again, not because of the acrid smell of burning seeping out of its windows, or the charred doors, but because of the memories that leapt out at her like fierce animals at the mere sight of the place. Sitting between Mo and her mother under one of the old oaks surrounding the parking lot, Maggie thought for a moment of Dustfinger, and wondered whether perhaps Capricorn had been telling the truth after all. Maybe he really was dead and buried somewhere in the hills. "I may never find out what's happened to him," she thought, as one of the blue fairies rocked back and forth on a twig above her, its face bland and happy. The whole village seemed to be enchanted that night. The air was full of buzzing and murmuring, and the figures wandering around the parking lot looked as if they had escaped from the dreams of children and not the words of an old man. That was something else Maggie kept asking herself during the night. Where was Fenolio now, and did he like it in his own story? She so much hoped so, but she knew he would miss his grandchildren and their games of hide-and-seek in his kitchen cupboard. Before Maggie's eyes closed, she saw Eleanor walking around among the trolls and fairies, looking happier than she had ever seen her. And her own parents were sitting to the left and right of Maggie, and her mother was writing and writing, on leaves from the trees, on the fabric of her dress, in the sand. There were so many words, so many tales to tell. Chapter 58. Homesickness. Dustfinger watched it all from a rooftop far enough away from the scene of Capricorn's festivities for him to feel safe from the shadow, but close enough for him to see everything through the binoculars he had found in Buster's house. At first, he had meant to stay in hiding. He had seen the shadow kill too often already. Yet a strange feeling, as irrational as Buster's good luck charms, had driven him out. A feeling that he could protect the book just by his presence. When he slipped into the alley, he felt something else too. He didn't like to admit it to himself, but he wanted to see Buster die through the same binoculars Buster himself had so often turned on his future victims. So he sat on the tiles of a dilapidated roof, his back against the cold chimney, his face blackened with soot, for the face is treacherously pale by night, and watched smoke rise into the sky from Capricorn's house. He saw Flatnose set out with several men to extinguish the fire. He saw the shadow emerge from the ground. He saw the old man disappear with an expression of infinite amazement on his face. And he saw Capricorn die the death Fenolio himself had summoned. Unfortunately, Buster did not die, which was really annoying. Dustfinger saw him running away, and he saw the magpie follow him. He, Dustfinger, the spectator, saw it all. He had often been just a spectator, and this was not his story. What were they to him, Silvertongue and his daughter, the boy, the bookworm, and the woman who was another man's wife once more? She could have escaped with him, but she had stayed in the crypt with her daughter, so he had thrust her out of his heart, as he always did with anyone who tried to stay there too long. He was glad that the shadow hadn't taken them all, but they were none of his business any more. From now on, Racer would be telling Silvertongue all the wonderful stories that drove away loneliness and homesickness and fear again. Why should it bother him? But what about the fairies and the goblins suddenly stumbling around the scene of Capricorn's festivities? They were as out of place in this world as he was, and they, too, wouldn't let him forget that he was still here for only one reason. He was interested only in the book, nothing but the book. And when he saw Silvertongue hide it under his jacket, he decided to get it back. The book, at least, would be his. It must be his. He would stroke the pages, and if he closed his eyes at the same time, he would be home again. The old man was there now, the old man with the wrinkled face. Crazy. "If only you hadn't been so afraid, Dustfinger," he thought bitterly. "But you're a coward, and you always will be. Why wasn't it you standing beside Capricorn? Why didn't you venture down? Then perhaps you would have disappeared back into the book instead of the old man." The fairy with the butterfly wings and milky white face had flown after him. She was a vain little thing. Whenever she caught sight of her reflection in a window, she lingered, smiling in front of it, oblivious to all else. She turned and preened in the air, ran her fingers through her hair, and examined herself as if delighted by her own beauty all over again. The fairies he had known had not been particularly vain. On the contrary, sometimes they positively enjoyed smearing their tiny faces with mud or pollen, and then asked him, giggling, to guess which of them it was behind all the muck. "Perhaps I ought to catch myself one," thought Dustfinger. "They could make me invisible. It would be wonderful to be invisible now and then. Or a troll. I could make him part of my show. Everyone would think he was just a little human being in a furry suit. No one can stand on his head as long as a troll. No one can make faces so well either. And those funny little dances they do. Yes, why not?" When the moon had travelled halfway across the sky, and Dustfinger was still sitting on the roof, the fairy with the butterfly wings grew impatient. Her tinkling sounded shrill and angry as she flew around him. What did she want? Did she want him to take her back where she came from, back to the place where all fairies had butterfly wings and people understood their language? "You've picked the wrong man here," he told her quietly. "See that girl down there, and the man beside the woman with the dark blonde hair? That's what you need. But I might as well warn you, they're very good at luring people into their world, and not so good at sending them home again. Still, you can try. Maybe you'll have better luck than me." The fairy turned in the air, looked down, cast him a final injured glance, and flew away. Dustfinger saw her brightness mingle with the light of the other fairies flying around and chasing one another through the branches of the trees. They were so forgetful. No grief or sorrow lived more than a day in their little heads. And, who knows, perhaps the mild night air had already made them forget that this was not their own story. Faint light was coming into the sky by the time they were all asleep down there. Only the boy kept watch. He was a suspicious boy, always on his guard, always careful, except when he played with fire. Dustfinger couldn't help smiling when he thought of Farid's eager face and the way he had burned his lips when he secretly took the torches from his backpack. The boy would be no problem, no, none at all. Silvertongue and Racer were asleep under a tree with Maggie between them, sheltered like a young bird in a warm nest. Eleanor was sleeping not far away and smiling in her sleep. Dustfinger had never seen her look so happy. One of the fairies was lying curled up like a caterpillar on her breast, with Eleanor's hand around it. The fairy's face was not much bigger than the ball of her thumb, and her fairy light shone between Eleanor's strong fingers like the light of a captive star. Farid stood up as soon as he saw Dustfinger coming. He had a shotgun in his hand. It must have belonged to one of Capricorn's men.
"You! You're not dead!" Farid breathed incredulously.
He still wore no shoes, which was hardly surprising, for he had always been falling over the shoelaces, and tying a bow had presented him with problems.
"No, I'm not."
Dustfinger stopped beside Silvertongue and looked down on him and Racer.
"Where's Gwyn?" he asked the boy. "I hope you've been looking after him."
"He ran away after they shot at us. But he came back."
There was pride in the boy's voice.
"Ah."
Dustfinger crouched down beside Silvertongue.
"Well, he always knew when it was time to run, just like his master."
"We left him at our camp by the burnt-out cottage last night, because we knew it was going to be dangerous," the boy went on. "But I was going to fetch him as soon as I came off watch."
"Well, I can do that now. Don't worry, he's sure to be all right. A marten like Gwyn will always survive."
Dustfinger reached out his hand and put it under Silvertongue's jacket.
"What are you doing?"
The boy's voice sounded uneasy.
"Just taking what's mine," replied Dustfinger.
Silvertongue did not stir as Dustfinger slipped the book out. He was sleeping well and soundly, and what was there now to disturb his sleep? He had everything his heart desired.
"It's not yours."
"Yes, it is."
Dustfinger stood up. He looked up at the branches. There were three fairies asleep up there. He'd always wondered how they could sleep perched in the trees without falling to the ground. Carefully, he took two of them off the spindly branch where they were lying, blew gently into their faces as they opened their eyes and yawned, and put them in his pocket.
"Blowing at them makes them sleepy," he explained to the boy. "Just a little tip, in case you ever have anything to do with fairies. But I think it works only on the blue kind."
He didn't bother to wake a troll. They were an obstinate lot. It would take a long time to persuade one of them to go with him, and very likely it would disturb Silvertongue.
"Let me come too,"
the boy barred his way.
"Here, I've got your backpack."
He held it up as if to buy Dustfinger's company with it.
"No."
Dustfinger took the pack from him, slung it over his shoulders, and turned his back on the boy.
"Yes," Farid ran after him. "You must let me come too. Or what am I going to tell Silvertongue when he realizes the book is gone?"
"Tell him you fell asleep. It happens to a lot of sentries keeping watch."
"Please."
Dustfinger stopped.
"What about her?"
He pointed to Maggie.
"You like the girl, don't you? Why not stay with her?"
The boy blushed and stared at the girl for a long time, as if to commit the sight of her to memory. Then he turned back to Dustfinger.
"I don't belong with them."
"You don't belong with me either."
Dustfinger walked away again, but when he was a good way from the parking lot, the boy was still behind him. He was trying to walk so quietly that Dustfinger wouldn't hear him, and when Dustfinger turned, he stopped like a thief caught in the act.
"What's the idea? I'm not going to be here much longer anyway," snapped Dustfinger. "Now that I have the book, I will look for someone who can read me into it again, even if it's a stammerer like Darius who sends me home with a lame leg or a squashed face. What will you do then? You'll be left alone."
The boy shrugged his shoulders and looked at him with his black eyes.
"I can breathe fire well now," he said. "I practiced and practiced while you were gone. But I'm not so good at swallowing it yet."
"That's more difficult. You go at it too fast. I've told you so 1,000 times.
They found Gwyn in the ruins of the burnt-out house, sleepy and with feathers around his muzzle. He seemed pleased to see Dustfinger, and even licked his hand. But then he ran after the boy. They walked until it was light, always reaching south toward the sea. At last they stopped for a rest and ate the food Dustfinger had brought from Basta's larder. Some red spicy sausage, a piece of cheese, bread, olive oil. The bread was rather hard, so they dipped it in the oil, ate in silence, sitting side by side on the grass, and then went on. Blue and dusty pink wild sage flowered among the trees. The fairies moved in Dustfinger's pocket, and the boy walked behind him like a second shadow. Chapter 59 Going Home. In the morning, when Mo found the book was gone, Maggie's first thought was that Basta had taken it,
and she felt sick with fear at the thought of him prowling around them while they slept. But Mo had a different explanation.
"Farid is gone too, Maggie," he said. "Do you think he'd have gone with Basta?"
No, she didn't. There was only one person Farid would have gone with. Maggie could well imagine Dustfinger emerging from the darkness, just as he had on the night when it all began.
"But what about Fenolio?" she said.
Mo only sighed.
"I don't know whether I'd have tried to read him back anyway, Maggie," he said. "So much misfortune has come from that book already, and I'm not a writer who can make up for himself the words he wants to read aloud. I'm only a kind of book doctor. I can give books new bindings, rejuvenate them a little, stop the bookworms from eating them, and prevent them from losing their pages over the years like a man loses his hair. But inventing the stories in them, filling new, empty pages with the right words, I can't do that. That's a very different trade. A famous writer once wrote, 'An author can be seen as three things, a storyteller, a teacher, or a magician. But the magician, the enchanter, is in the ascendant.' I always thought he was right about that." Maggie didn't know what to say. She only knew she missed Fenolio's face.
"And Tinkerbell," she said. "What about her? Will she have to stay here too now?"
When she'd woken up, the fairy had been lying in the grass beside her. Now she was flying around with the other fairies. If you didn't look too closely, they might have been a flock of moths. Maggie couldn't imagine how she had escaped from Basta's house. Hadn't he been planning to keep her in a jug?
"As far as I remember, Peter Pan himself once forgot she'd ever existed," said Mo. "Am I right?"
Yes, Maggie remembered it too.
"All the same," she murmured. "Poor Fenolio."
But as she said that, her mother shook her head vigorously. Mo searched his pockets for paper, though all he could find was a shopping receipt and a felt-tip pen. Teresa took both from him, smiling. Then, while Maggie crouched in the grass beside her, she wrote, "Don't be sorry for Fenolio. It's not a bad story he's landed in."
"Is Capricorn still in it? Did you ever meet him there?" asked Maggie.
How often she and Mo had wondered that. After all, he was one of the main characters in Inkheart. But perhaps there really was something behind the printed story. A world that changed every day, just like this one.
"I only heard of him there," her mother wrote. "They spoke of him as if he had gone away for a while. But there were others just as bad. It's a world full of terror and beauty."
Here her writing became so small, Maggie could hardly make it out.
"And I could always understand why Dustfinger felt homesick for it."
The last sentence worried Maggie, but when she looked anxiously at her mother, Teresa smiled and reached for her hand.
"I was far, far more homesick for you too,"
she wrote on the palm of it. And Maggie closed her fingers over the words as if to hold them fast. She read them again and again on the long drive back to Eleanor's house, and it was many days before they faded. Eleanor hadn't been able to reconcile herself to the idea of another walk all the way down through the thorny hills where the snakes lived.
"Do you think I'm crazy?" she said crossly. "My feet hurt at the mere thought of it."
So she and Maggie had set off again in search of a telephone. It was a strange feeling to walk through the village, a truly deserted village now, past Capricorn's smoke-blackened house and the half-charred church porch. Water lay in the square outside. The blue sky was reflected in it and made it look almost as if the square had turned into a lake overnight. The hoses Capricorn's men had used to save their master's house lay like huge snakes in the pools of water. In fact, the fire had ravaged only the ground floor, but all the same Maggie would not go in. And when they had searched over a dozen other houses in vain, Eleanor bravely went through the charred door on her own. Maggie told her where to find the magpie's room, and Eleanor took a gun just in case the old woman had come back to save what she could of her own and her robber son's treasures. But the magpie had long gone, just like Buster, and Eleanor came back with a triumphant smile on her lips, carrying a cordless phone. They called a taxi. It was somewhat difficult to persuade the driver he must ignore the road barrier when he came to it, but luckily he had never believed any of the sinister stories that were told of the village. They arranged to wait for him by the roadside so he wouldn't see any of the fairies and trolls. Maggie and her mother stayed in the village while Mo and Eleanor went in the taxi to the nearest town and came back a few hours later, driving the two small buses they had rented. For Eleanor had decided to offer a home, or asylum, as she put it, to all the strange creatures who had landed in her world. "After all," she said, "many people here have little enough patience or understanding for their fellow human beings, who are only superficially different than them. So how would it be for little people with blue skins who can fly?" It took some time for them all to understand Eleanor's offer, which was, of course, also made to the men, women, and children out of the book. But most of them decided to stay in Capricorn's village. It obviously reminded them of a home that their earlier death had almost made them forget. And, of course, they could use the treasure that Maggie told the children must still be lying in the cellars of Capricorn's house. It would probably be enough to keep them all the rest of their lives. The birds, dogs, and cats who had emerged from the shadow had not hung around, but had long ago disappeared into the surrounding hills, while a few fairies and two of the little glass men, enchanted by the broom blossoms, the scent of rosemary, and the narrow alleys where the ancient stones whispered their stories to them, decided to make the once sinister village their home. In the end, however, 43 blue-skinned fairies with dragonfly wings fluttered into the buses and settled on the backs of the grey-patterned seats. Capricorn had obviously swatted fairies as carelessly as other people swat flies. Tinkerbell was among those who didn't come, which did not particularly trouble Maggie, for she had realized that Peter Pan's fairy was very self-centered. Her tinkling really got on your nerves, too, and she tinkled almost all the time if she didn't get what she wanted. In addition to four trolls, who looked like very small and hairy human beings, 13 little glass men and women climbed into Eleanor's buses. And so did Darius, the unhappy, stammering reader. There was nothing to keep him in the village with its new inhabitants, and it held too many painful memories for him. He offered to help Eleanor build up her library again, and she accepted. Maggie suspected she was secretly toying with the idea of getting Darius to read aloud again, now that Capricorn's malevolent presence no longer left him tongue-tied. Maggie looked back for a long time as they left Capricorn's village behind them. She knew she would never forget the sight of it, just as you never forget many stories, even though, or perhaps because, they have scared you. Before they left, Mo had asked her, with concern in his voice, whether she minded if they drove to Eleanor's first. Maggie did not mind at all. Oddly enough, she felt more homesick for Eleanor's house than for the old farmhouse where she and Mo had lived for the last few years. The scar left by the bonfire was still visible on the lawn behind the house where Capricorn's men had piled up the books and burned them. But before Eleanor had had the ashes taken away, she had filled a jam jar with the fine grey dust, and it stood on the bedside table in her room. Many of the books that Capricorn's men had only swept off the shelves were already back in their old places. Others were waiting on Mo's workbench to be rebound. But the library shelves were empty. As they stood looking at them, Maggie saw the tears in Eleanor's eyes, even though she was quick to wipe them away. Eleanor did a great deal of buying over the next few weeks. She bought books. She travelled all over Europe in search of them. Darius was always with her, and sometimes Mo went with them too. But Maggie stayed in the big house with her mother. They would sit together at a window, looking out at the garden where the fairies were building themselves nests, gently glowing globes that hung among the branches of the trees. The glass men and women settled into Eleanor's attic, and the trolls dug caves among the big old trees that grew in abundance in Eleanor's garden. She told them all that they should never leave her property, warning them urgently of the dangers of the world beyond the hedges that enclosed it. But soon the fairies were flying down to the lake by night, the trolls were walking along its banks and stealing into the sleeping villages, and the little glass people would disappear into the tall grass that covered the slopes of the mountains around the lake.
"Don't worry too much," said Mo, whenever Eleanor bewailed their stupidity. "After all, the world they came from wasn't without its dangers."
"But it was different," cried Eleanor. "There were no cars. Suppose the fairies fly into a windshield. And there were no hunters with rifles shooting at anything that moves just for the fun of it."
By now, Eleanor knew everything about the world of Inkheart. Meggie's mother had needed a great deal of paper to write down her memories of it. Every evening, Meggie asked her to tell more stories, and then they sat together while Teresa wrote, and Meggie read the words and sometimes even tried to paint pictures of what her mother described. The days went by, and Eleanor's shelves filled up with wonderful new books. Some of them were in poor condition, and Darius, who had begun to draw up a catalogue of Eleanor's printed treasures, kept interrupting his own work to watch Mo at his. He sat there, wide-eyed, as Mo freed a badly worn book from its old cover, fixed loose pages back, glued the spines in place, and did whatever else was necessary to preserve the books for many more years to come. Long after all this, Meggie couldn't have said exactly when they had decided to stay on with Eleanor. Perhaps not for many weeks, or perhaps they had known from the first day they were back. Meggie was given the room with the bed that was much too big for her, and which still had her book box standing under it. She would have loved to read aloud to her mother from her own favourite books, but of course she understood why Mo very seldom did so, even now. And one night, when she couldn't get to sleep because she thought she saw Basta's face out in the dark, she sat down at the desk in front of her window and began to write, while the fairies played in Eleanor's garden and the trolls rustled in the bushes. For Meggie had a plan. She wanted to learn to make up stories like Fenolio. She wanted to learn to fish for words, so that she could read aloud to her mother without worrying about who might come out of the stories and look at her with homesick eyes. So Meggie decided words would be her trade. And where better could she learn that trade than in a house full of magical creatures, where fairies built their nests in the garden and books whispered on the shelves by night? As Mo had said, writing stories is a kind of magic, too. This is Lynn Redgrave. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Inkheart by Cornelia Funke. This program was produced and directed by Robert Kessler. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Original text copyright 2003 by Dressler Verlag. English translation 2003 by The Chicken House. Production copyright 2003. Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.